I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you will see the link to become a Patreon donor in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we don't have any scheduled guests, so I thought I would go back into the archives and read some old bodybuilding articles from the magazines, particularly Muscle Builder and Power Magazine, and also Muscle and Fitness Magazine, Joe Weider's famous magazine that he published. These will be from the 1970s and the 1980s. I just put up a video on YouTube this last week. It was an old one, an old interview we did in January of 2022. And this was right after Chris Dickerson passed away. So we did a Chris Dickerson tribute show with Boyer Coe and Roy Callender. And I also had NPC Judge Bill Nealon, who was a good friend of Chris Dickerson. All three of these guys were on the show. And we talked about Chris, and Boyer and Roy talked about their experiences competing with Chris and what they thought of Chris's physique and Chris as a person. So I just put that up on YouTube this last week. So I'm going to read some of the comments I got from that. I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool to go back and just look at some of the articles by these bodybuilders who won the Mr. Olympia, not the ones who won the Mr. Olympia like Ronnie, Arnold, or Lee Haney, where they won, you know, 6, 7, 8 times, but some of the bodybuilders that only won the Mr. Olympia like once or twice, like Samir Benoit and Chris Dickerson. Frank Zane won it 3 times. Franco won it 2 times. So in that period from 1976 to 1983, 84, we had different bodybuilders winning the title, and kind of like what's been happening with the Mr. Olympia lately, where we had different winners almost every year since 2018. So it's quite different from what it was for many, many years before that, where Lee Haney won 8 in a row, and then Dorian Yates won 6 in a row, and then Ronnie Coleman took over and he won 8 in a row. And then Jay Cutler started winning, and he only won 2, and then he started losing, and then he gained it back. It's been changing hands much more frequently over the last 10 years or so compared to how it used to be. So I thought it would be cool to go back and read some of these old articles from Muscle Builder and Muscle and Fitness and read what it was like from these guys when they first won the coveted Mr. Olympia title. All right. So what else is going on with you guys out there in the world? We got Thanksgiving coming up this week. It's unbelievable. It's already Thanksgiving. Christmas is right around the corner, of course. And then we got New Year's and the start of a new year, 2024. Unbelievable how fast time is going by, how fast this year went by. It's crazy. I saw an interview with The Rock. He was interviewed by Joe Rogan this last week. It was a pretty interesting interview. And one thing he said on there was they were talking about how fast time goes by now. And The Rock was saying because of social media, he thinks that time is going by faster, which I agree with. It seems like we're so distracted by social media now where we never had that before. And it just seems like it makes everything go by quicker. So it's crazy. Enjoy your time while we're here, right, guys? All right. We did get one email from last week. And it says, hey, John, as always, I thoroughly enjoyed your last interview with Paul Becker. Knowing your level of bodybuilding history and knowledge, I was surprised when you said during the interview you'd never seen Mike Mentzer's video when he was training Marcus Reinhardt. It is must viewing, and it's available on YouTube. I would also recommend watching the behind-the-scenes clips also on YouTube. These are very comical, and it shows Mike and Brother Ray sitting outside the gym at a table and discussing life. It's quite comical. Paul Becker is right. Mike and Ray looked very old in these video clips. It was kind of sad. Mike was taking frequent smoking breaks between video takes. He looks very old and almost crippled. Thanks again for continuing to put out excellent content. I never miss a show. Scott Billings from Stillwater, Oklahoma. All right, I'll have to check out those videos. Yeah, I've seen them, but I never really watched them. I think one of the reasons I probably never watched them was because I kind of knew Mike was at the end and he wasn't at his peak. So I think that's why I probably never really checked them out. But yeah, I'll have to check them out if you think it's worth watching. I also want to read all these comments I got from this last video I put up on YouTube, which was the Chris Dickerson tribute with Boyer Coe and Roy Callender. So this one was from Pinnacle Pete. It says, another great show, John. I got to meet Chris at a seminar he gave at A&R Gym in Belleville, New Jersey, towards the end of 1974. Chris did a workout post for us and then answered our questions. He was the first pro bodybuilder I ever saw in person, and it was mind-blowing to see somebody with that much developed muscle in person back then. In the book Pumping Iron, it mentions that Serge Nubre drank 40 glasses of water a day. I used to wonder why. Why wasn't he drinking a gallon of milk with calories and protein like Larry Scott did, or drinking protein drinks like Sergio Oliva? I asked Chris this question, and as you might expect, he didn't have an answer for me. I saw Chris in person one more time in the 1980s. He gave a short speech at a large sports complex in West Orange, New Jersey, wearing a suit. There was a weight room right next to the area where he was going to speak, and Phil Grappaldi, a New Jersey guy, was working out. Phil noticed Chris, who hadn't started the speech yet, so he walked over and spoke to him for almost 10 minutes. You could tell they knew each other and they were getting reacquainted. I never made the connection back then, but Phil started out as a bodybuilder, developed those big-ass arms, and then switched to Olympic lifting, where he became one of America's best. Chris started out as Olympic lifter, switched to bodybuilding, where he became one of America's best. Yeah, Phil Grappaldi had a great physique. I remember seeing pictures of him and some of Hoffman's old magazines. Like he said, he had huge arms. This one came from TP. It says, I remember seeing Roy in the magazines back in the day. He always impressed me with his physique. This interview is the first time I've heard him talk about his experience, and I have great respect for him. Thanks for having him on, and I hope he can be in a future episode. Yeah, we've had Roy in a few episodes, so you'll have to check those out on the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. This one says, another great show and tribute. I always enjoy seeing and listening to Boyer, one of my favorite bodybuilders from the golden era. Glad to see him and Roy looking well. And then this one says, great show. I live in Oregon, and I knew Bill Pearl, and I miss bodybuilding the way it was back then. I even miss the magazines. This one says, Boyer Coe mentioned being in West Paterson, New Jersey at the beginning of the video. 14 years ago, that township voted to change their name. The town is now called Woodland Park, in case anyone were to look it up. I didn't know that. This one says, my kind of interview. Thanks for all this effort. Some great trivia here towards the end. Rest in peace, Chris. This one says, I met Dennis Tinerino back in 1990 when he was preaching at Four Square Church in Malibu. I attended one of his Sunday and Saturday night services when the place was packed to overflowing. I had to get there over an hour early to get a seat. Wow. He did mention Boyer Coe and Chris Dickerson, amongst whom he thought were the good guys. Also, Sameer Banut, Jerry Branham, and Bill Pearl. Interestingly, he did not mention Arnold S. This one says, badass episode, one of the best podcasts out there. Big ups and respects. Latman said, I wish Roy Callender said how he learned to train his calves from Chris. Devin said, this is great. I talk about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, and I was born in 1979. Luke said, great show. Bad Cat said, I delivered DoorDash to Mr. Boyer a couple of years ago. That's hilarious. And this last one from Donnie says, I knew Roy Callender from Canada when I lived there is in the 1970s. A great, humble man. And he said, Boyer was arrogant, not a nice man, came to do a guest posing, and I did not care to interact with the fans. Roy did. Huh. Well, that hasn't been my experience. I think Boyer is a great guy. I've done a lot of interviews with him, so I've had some really good experiences with Boyer. Real gentleman, in my opinion. But he might have been having an off day that day. Who knows? All right. Well, without any further ado, guys, let me read some of these articles here. So we're going to start with Frank Zane. So we're going to go back to the February 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And this was written by our favorite writer, Rick Wayne. And it is about Frank Zane after he won his first Mr. Olympia in 1977. And it's called How the Kid with the Football Exploded Robbie's Dream. Quote, if you don't have a dream, how are you going to make a dream come true? In late October 1976, I had this dream. I dreamed I was on the beach and Robbie threw this pass, a spiral pass, high in the air and long, 80 yards maybe. And then this kid comes along, at Venice Beach it was, and he picks up the football and he throws a pass, an incredible pass that was so much longer than Robbie's. Now, in my dream, I knew who the kid was, and yet I couldn't quite recognize him. Well, he threw that football, and it hit a hangar. The hangar had a model airplane in it, and when the ball landed, the whole thing just blew up. Frank Zane, November 1977. He came to the door on my second ring, long hair still wet from his second shower that day, still flushed from his evening workout at the World Gym on Main Street in Santa Monica. It occurred to me almost immediately that I never before had seen Frank Zane as large, nor even as pleased with himself. He reminded me, for some insane reason, of the Mona Lisa. Yes, that's the picture that came into my head the minute I set eyes on him in the semi-darkness of his doorway. He shook my hand, and then he noticed that Cheshire Cat smile on his face, every pore oozing a kind of, I told you I could work miracles, and now you know I can, confidence. Or maybe it was just that I was reacting from the effects of a stomach overfull with humble pie. After all, Frank Zane had coolly gone and done the impossible. He had wiped the floor clean, destroyed Ken Waller, Albert Beckles, Bill Grant, and Robbie Robinson, Coe and Corny too, with one devastating clean sweep. With just 185 pounds of body, Zane had demolished all the heavyweight dreams of some of the biggest men in bodybuilding today. Yes, you found yourself actually wondering whether he might have also handled Sergio Oliva, had the latter validated rumors of a threatened return to the Olympia boards. Frank Zane is Mr. Olympia in 1977, just as he predicted he would be when he conceived his The Year of Zane line for his various advertisements. I follow him into his lived-in living room, meet his gorgeous Christine, who offers her cheek and tea. Meanwhile, Frank is tidying a table where he's been preparing some correspondence. I'm fascinated by the book titles on his bookshelf. Anne Faraday's Dream Power, Learning to Understand Vitally Important Messages About You from the One Person Who Really Knows You, Yourself. The New World of Dreams, Mind Styles, Lifestyles, Creative Dreaming. Who's to say now that a man is not what he reads? Indeed, there are very few events in the life and times of Frank Zane that were not heralded by some dream. In 1974, for example, prior to Zane's war for the Olympia under 200 title against Franco Colombo, a warning came his way via a Schwarzenegger vision. Arnold had this dream, he told me in 1975, just before the 74 Olympia that was held in New York. He told me that in his dream, Franco had talked me into putting this green paint all over my body. The paint was supposed to give me fantastic definition. But on the night of the contest, I blended into the green curtains and the judges simply didn't see me at all. All they saw was Franco, who never put the paint on himself. And so Zane failed in his second attempt to capture the Mr. Olympia title. As Arnold's dream had foretold, his initial outing was similarly disastrous. That year, in 1972, they held the Olympia in Essen, Arnold country, he recalls with a chuckle. I'd just taken the Professional Mr. Universe Award. Sergio was there in probably his best ever shape, but Arnold won. Zane did not compete for the Olympia in 73. I retired, he said mysteriously. Did Sergio have something to do with that, I wondered? I mean, it couldn't have been easy for a relatively slender guy like you to lock horns with Oliva, Arnold, Nubray, and Franco all in the same night. No, I wasn't bothered by the size of those people. Size has never given me any trouble. I never felt I was going to win that particular contest, but I thought I had a good chance. I felt I should have been third. You know, up until recently, I've always competed on an uneven basis with the other guys. I was a part-time bodybuilder, while they were particularly full-time bodybuilders. I was always a school teacher first and a bodybuilder the remainder of the time. Arnold has for years been a bodybuilder full-time, and Sergio was more or less the same. I had to do my serious training in the summer. I always relied on that as sort of an excuse for losing, I suppose, but that's going to change. I will, for a while anyway, be first and foremost a bodybuilder. His 75 Mr. Olympia outing was also preceded by a dream that warned Zane not to compete. In that dream, he recalls, I parked my car in a street at a parking meter. There are maybe three or four other cars parked similarly on the street. When I returned from whatever I had to do, the car is missing. It's just vanished. Later, I discovered that Joe Weider had moved it to a huge parking lot where there were a lot of other cars. My car doors open and papers are spread all over the seats. When I opened the glove department, my wallet is still there with all my cash and my Bank AmeriCard. Months later, after his worst contest appearance ever in South Africa, Zane explained, the car represented my physical body, my machine. Before I started training for the 75 Mr. Olympia, I was on my own course, going to school for a degree and not training much. I was on a street by myself, so to speak. So Joe Weider takes my machine, my body, in fact, and he puts it in with the other bodies in the contest, and I get messed up, like the papers in the car in my dream. But I retained all that was valuable to me. I kept my integrity. I did not resort to dirty tricks to win. I didn't go against principles that I hold dear. Now I can feel it all coming together for the 1976 Mr. Olympia, which also was preceded by a dream that involved this writer. Frank dreamed that he had chopped off my neck with an axe by accident. And not long afterwards, I, who planned on being serious competition at the 1976 Mr. Olympia, had to pull out at the last minute on account of a pain in the neck, upper back. But you've read all about that. The records show that Frank Zane lost to Franco Colombo by 1 point. His fans could hardly believe their ears when it was announced that Franco was the new Mr. Olympia. Now Frank Zane says of that particular decision that he was in really great shape and he should have won. Would have won had the placement system been used instead of the point system. I've always preferred the placement system. It's so much easier to make a choice that way. You complicate things when you start assigning points for this and that, especially as many as 20 points. I like the judging this year. The way they did it, they had the prejudging by the point system and the class winners were chosen. And then in the evening, they had the top six guys in a pose down and they placed them in order via the placement method. The scores were 11 for me, 15 for Robbie, and 17 for Corny. The lowest score wins, of course. It's been said that Frank Zane was in far better shape when he did battle with Colombo last year than he was in 1977. Waller, for one, holds that opinion. Nonsense, says the man who should know. I was in better shape this time around. I was possibly more muscular than before, certainly not less. Plus, I was about 5 pounds heavier than last year. I was bigger around the legs and chest, which accounted for the extra weight. I trained pretty heavy during the summer. I was also doing a film. We shot the movie over 12 weekends, which gave me time for training. I trained just 5 days a week, very heavy, 3 sets of each exercise, maybe a total of 10 or 12 sets per body part. I went for maximum poundages each set. First set was like 20 reps, second set 15, and third 10 or 12. I just kept on increasing the weight each set. I trained that way for about 2 months. Then I had an exhibition in Philadelphia around the middle of September. I was a little smooth then. On my return home, I started training 6 days a week, also hitting the weights 2 or 3 times in the afternoon, you know, twice daily. Soon, work on the film was over and nothing else mattered but serious preparations for the Olympia. I went into a program of intensive training that involved 12 workouts a week, twice a day, every day. Gym propaganda had it in the last few months before the Olympia that Frank Zane was so fractured with training injuries, he could not handle heavy poundages and would come out skinny and soft on the big day. The line was wrong, obviously. Zane elaborates, I can still handle heavy weights. It's true that I can't squat because of bad knees. I can't squat heavy, that is. And I can't do heavy presses behind the neck because of neck problems that I've had for years. But that's about all. All I did for shoulders were lateral exercises with cables and dumbbells. Dumbbell presses worked well for my shoulders. I squatted a lot for high reps with lighter poundages. My legs grow easily anyway. I really don't need heavy weights for them to grow at this point. How much training time went into the Zane posing routine? I wonder. Not much, at least not until the final week before the Olympia, Frank said. Did you have to cope with attempts to psych you out? Well, I heard about Waller trying to do that, but I can't really comment on how successful he was. The truth is, I just wasn't aware of those other guys. I was too busy working on winning to notice them. Frank Zane holds that his Olympia victory is also a feather in the cap of those bodybuilders for whom size, gargantuan size, that is an impossibility. One of the reasons I decided to continue training after last year was to prove that you don't have to be a monster size to win the Olympia or any other contest. So many guys simply don't have the potential to be big. And when they see the big guys winning over and over and over, well, it's kind of discouraging for them. As I see it, well, more than that, I know my victories have kept them going. It's not healthy anyway to maintain all that size all the time. Which brings us to Steve Davis and his new breed of bodybuilder modeled after himself. The idea of building a symmetrical body simply is not new, Frank Zane observed. And Davis is definitely not the first symmetrical body, and he won't be the last. The million-dollar question. Will you try to pull it off again next year? Can we plan on seeing you up here against Mensah and Robbie and the rest one more time? I'm not at all disturbed by the presence of those guys, he assured me. They'll just have to understand that I'm going to be a bodybuilder full-time from now on. I'm taking a year off schoolwork, and I'm going to be better than ever for the 78 Olympia. I've never been as motivated in my whole life. Has the recent move from Gold's to World's Gym been responsible? He says, the atmosphere at Gold's, well, when I first went there, it seemed nice and spacious, but the atmosphere is negative, very disorganized. The way the equipment is laid out in non-strategic places, there really isn't a gym feeling. At World Gym, well, the place was built from the ground up, specifically to be a gym. Everything is where it should be. So organized. I made my best gains training there. What about the bad vibes from competitors? One has heard a lot about people like Waller riding the energy out of you during workouts. That happened a lot at the old Gold's Gym, but there's none of that at World, where there seems to be more friendly competition. People encourage you to push ahead by their own efforts to make it. None of the insulting arguments and all that. I have to say, Waller was very nice to me this time around. He trains at World, and we never had an argument this year. Ken Waller has said he never considered Zane serious competition in the Olympia contest. Never even noticed him until the title went his way. I think Ken is living largely in a fantasy world, the new Mr. Olympia noted with resignation. He should wake up and take stock. He should study his photos from the contest most carefully. I've been looking at a lot of his shots, and all I saw was a silly smile and freckles. Remember what I said last year, that Ken would have been last had there been just one class at the Olympia. He almost made it, didn't he? To be serious, I think Ken would have done much better had he not been injured. But to say that he was in the best shape of his life is to hyperbolize needlessly. He had no triceps whatever in one arm. Couldn't even flex the arm. There was an obvious difference of something like 2 inches in his arms. You come like that to a Mr. Olympia contest, and what do you want? Somebody is bound to notice the imbalance. Was the 1977 Mr. Olympia a popularity contest, as Waller has claimed? How big a victor was sentiment for Zane in the contest result? I don't think there was any ocean of sentiment whipping up a victory for me. I hardly heard my name called out from the auditorium. Maybe a lot of my fans were pulling for me. That's not unusual. I had lots of letters, people who felt I should have won last year and were hoping like hell I would win this time. But if you check all the major magazine publications, you'll not see one predicting a win for me. Zane's lifestyle will change with his victory. I'll be doing a lot more traveling, he announced. I have bookings way into next year. I'll be doing more clinics, personal appearances, and so on. The whole thing stands to benefit me financially, but I feel I have a contribution to make to bodybuilding. I have my new courses. There's my wife's new book on bodybuilding for women. It'll be a busy time for both of us. Talking of your wife, how much pressure on your marriage has resulted from being a competitive bodybuilder, I asked. Well, Christina and I have been married 12 years, and we've had our ups and downs like any other normal couple. I suppose there's been particular pressure on the marriage when we were both teaching and I was preparing for contests, but she quit teaching. Hey, I never really won anything until Christine and I were married. Eddie Giuliani once told me his marriage had survived while most others in bodybuilding did not, because bodybuilders tend to pick glamour girls for marriage, and when the body begins to go and the glamour pales, well, then out goes the marriage. Zane says simply that you have to be unselfish. You have to give and take in marriage, and that's what Christine and I try to do. Later, I would talk to Mrs. Zane, she who was there in November 1976, when Frank told me he was through with physique competition. Did she change his mind for him? No, I didn't, the former Miss Americana smiled sweetly. He was, well, disappointed at coming so close on winning that year. Anyway, I saw he looked so sad. I encouraged him to have another go. We both knew he was going to win in 1977. We knew in June. How? Well, I sneaked a peek at Robbie and I felt he was too big. Her husband was interjecting. Yeah, too big, much too big, he said. Besides, Christine went on, Frank had the dream, the one about the kid on the beach. And by June, we both knew who that kid was with the football that caused the explosion. We knew we were going to explode Robbie's big dream. Frank Zane again. You can't stay in contest shape all year round. That's one of the big lessons I've learned in my bodybuilding career. Sure, it's nice to stay in fairly good shape, like shape for exhibitions, where you're fairly cut and big. You have to be out of your mind if you think your body is going to tolerate the hardships of contest preparation for a year or two, as Robbie has been doing. I turn to Christine again. Tell me about those courses you're putting out. When? How did you get the idea? She grinned shyly. Well, I've been going to this ladies' studio for some time now, and I see all those fat women who've also been coming for years, and they don't change. They don't shape up. And I realized they were all getting the wrong training information. Now they can do it right for my courses. She showed me some of the illustrations for her course. Alone, they'd be worth the price of the course. Recently, Frank ventured into the world of movies with a starring part in a vehicle called Sagan. He plays the hero, naturally enough, and is responsible for the demise of Steve Davis, Roger Callard, and one or two other lesser light bodybuilders. I asked him if Sagan signaled the start of a new career. I enjoyed doing the movie, he replied. I have an agent and I'll be willing to do things that make some sense. In other words, if the part is right, I'll do it. But I'm not about to be doing those stay hungry extra scenes. He's given much of the time he once had for archery, Frank Zane says with a note of regret. I don't seem to have much time on my hands now with preparing new courses, making personal appearances, and working on a special book with Christine. And an even busier time lies ahead. As we talked, Zane took 3 phone calls, all offering fat contracts for personal appearances. No wonder he was smiling when I came in. For Mr. Olympia 1977, the future looks bright indeed. Muscle Builder wishes him a happy time now that perseverance has rewarded Frank Zane at last. Indeed, if courage were measurable, say as one might measure his biceps or take his weight, a special weight category would have to be created for the man. For few bodybuilders have displayed the self-confidence and courage of Frank Zane. 1977 will long be remembered as the year of Zane. Deservedly so. The end. All right. Great article by Rick Wayne. All right. Now we will go forward to the 1981 Mr. Olympia, which was Franco's second Mr. Olympia. Of course, it was very controversial, but Franco was in great shape, except for the legs, of course. And he wrote an article in the April 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness. It was by this time Muscle and Fitness, not Muscle Builder. And it was written by Franco Colombo with Bill Dobbins. And it was a bodybuilder's notebook, How I Won the Mr. Olympia. Franco recalls his 5-year quest to win his second Olympia title. Editor's note, the following article is excerpted directly from Franco Colombo's personal diary, his notes on what he did and how he trained to win the 1981 Mr. Olympia title. We liked the directness and honesty of the style and decided simply to let Franco's own words speak for themselves. Injured knee in 1976, strongest man competition right after the Olympia, knee completely torn apart. Every time I tried to train, I hurt it again. Finally found ways of training thighs with corrective exercises, but no squats, deadlifts, or anything heavy like that. Lots of half leg extensions, stretching, walking up steps sideways to develop the sides of the knee. After a few years, I began doing light squats. It took years. Tried to get in shape for the Olympia last year, but the knee was still too weak. In February 1981, I went to Spain to do the movie Conan, and got way out of shape because I couldn't train. Jumped down from a rock and hurt the knee again. I thought it might be all over, that I wouldn't be able to train for the Olympia. Afraid that I wouldn't be able to compete at all. I got so depressed and out of shape, I didn't know how to start again. I decided simply to do stretching exercises. Then in April, Gregory Harrison, the actor, asked if I would train him for the TV movie For Ladies Only, all about male strippers. I said, sure, for a good fee. I ended up training him and I getting back into shape myself. I was encouraged by this to get back into shape. I did 1 hour of training, 1 hour stretching, 1 hour gymnastics, slowly building up the strength of the knee. In May, I decided that in June, I would train nothing but arms, not my best point, thighs and calves. Since my chest, back and shoulders grow with little training, I would leave them alone. If after that month, my arms look better than ever and my thighs look good, I would begin to train seriously for the Olympia. All during June, I worked out at World Gym, and everyone asked, what kind of training is this? One day arms, next day thighs and calves, next day arms, and so on. They said, what the hell is this? What about chest, back, abs, and shoulders? I said, forget it. I know I can get them up anytime. That doesn't worry me. At the end of June, I told myself that on the first day of July, I would look at myself in the mirror, look at the other guys in World Gym, and decide if I should compete. There was Samir, Tom Platz, Chris Dickerson, even if they never took their clothes off. And I liked the way I compared. So I said, I'm going to train the month of July. Still a lot of arms and thighs and a little bit of chest, back, and shoulders. Arms 3 times a week, thighs and calves 3 times a week, chest, back, and shoulders 1 a week. On August 1st, I looked in the mirror and I said, let's see if I look like the other guys. I looked in proportion. My weak points were up, and the other bodybuilders looked like always, like in every Grand Prix. Their weak points were still weak, their strong points still strong. Most of them were smooth. I'm never fat. I don't believe in bulking up a lot and then trying to get down the last month before the contest. I gain weight right up to the day of the contest. So in August, I started training without my shirt on and telling everybody I was going to compete in the Olympia. Everybody said, oh, it's too late for you. Only 2 months and 10 days. Every other contender told me he was going to win, and I said, sure. But I knew even in August that I was going to win because the other bodybuilders were putting so much energy into politics, trying to get on the covers of magazines and get their articles published in Muscle and Fitness. They thought they could win by gaining popularity, by publicity in the magazines, and through calling organizers, officials, and anyone who might be judging. I thought, let them do that. I'll put all my energy into training, and then at the last minute, when we get to the contest, all my energy will be in my body while theirs is out somewhere else. My training in August consisted of 20 sets of back, 20 sets of chest, 15 sets of shoulders, 15 sets triceps, 10 to 12 sets biceps, 15 sets thighs, and 10 sets calves. The reason for this proportion is this. All the bodybuilders were doing equal sets for every body part, so their good body parts kept getting better and their bad body parts stayed bad. Their small muscles stayed small and overtrained, and their big muscles were undertrained. So I gave the big muscles like chest and back a lot of sets, and I did fewer sets for the smaller muscles like biceps, which can't handle more than 10 or 12 sets or they'll burn out. This method gave me gains every day, and I gained 1 or 2 pounds of muscle every week, and I lost fat at the same time. The other guys were gaining 3 or 4 pounds, including a lot of fat. I was doing a lot of strange exercises. For example, incline curls to get the outside of the biceps. I wanted biceps on top of my biceps because everybody knows that my chest, shoulders, and back are the best, but they think my arms are skinny. I didn't want anybody able to say that. I wanted to develop 3-headed biceps if possible. I wanted my thighs to look as good as anyone's and my calves to look better. I look at the pictures and see the splits in my biceps. I got those only in the last few months of training. I started training every day with my shirt off. The others, Callender, Platts, Dickerson, Samir, they were all covered up from head to toe and not even taking showers when I was around. I found that a little bit disappointing. I would have liked to see what they look like. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the type of person that loves excitement, doesn't go into the gym to get in shape, wants to get in shape and make a lot of noise, scream and have fun. Bodybuilders get worried, too involved with their own thinking, but Arnold loves noise. So when I came in with my shirt on, Arnold would tell everyone, Franco's coming up all pumped up from downstairs. He'd say I pumped up and put oil on, even though I never did. He told some bodybuilders, Franco just came in. You go downstairs and I'll bet you any money he's doing push-ups. He actually made people believe it. And they came downstairs looking, which I thought was the funniest thing. Chris Dickerson. One day I go downstairs at World Gym and I notice him turning on the faucet to take a shower. He ran. He took the towel, took his clothes, got into his car, and went home to take a shower. Since then, he only takes a shower when I wasn't there, or he didn't shower at the gym. Other guys also went home to take showers, like they all had decided to keep Franco wondering by keeping their clothes on. I remember one day I came in and I heard Chris telling Roy Callender, Roy, I only worry about you. I don't worry about Franco. Because look, his shirt is off. He's all pumped up. He's out of proportion. You want to keep him wondering. Don't take your clothes off. And Roy says, I never take my clothes off. I overheard this, and so did Eddie Giuliani, who told me Chris wasn't worried about me. So I say, how big is his arm? Almost 17 inches, Eddie answers. I go tell him my arm is 19 and looks better, I reply. As time went along, I could see who was really training hard. I was, and so were Roy Callender and Tom Platts. In my opinion, we were the 3 people who were really training hard, and we would be at the top. Chris Dickerson trained pretty hard, but I was surprised he got it together because he was training with such light weights. By September 1st, I was already in better shape than all of them. Samir came to me and said, I'm going to start cutting down. I said to him, you'd better cut down before the contest, not after it. I actually overtrained every week. The overtraining broke down my fat. In the second week of September, I was supposed to go away and I decided not to train for 4 days, but I needed the rest. For 4 weeks, I had not missed a training day, even Saturdays and Sundays. Besides, I was taking care of my chiropractic business at the same time. My schedule, 7 to 9 a.m. in the gym, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. adjusting patients, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. back in the gym. On this Weider double split schedule, I got my fat down to nothing. When I didn't train those 4 days, I felt so good and so rested. Stage three of my preparation. From the 10th of September, only 4 weeks to go. Now gaining more slowly, only a pound a week, trying to get my body weight up to 188, figuring I would lose 2 or 3 pounds the last few days with the aggravation and being nervous and worried, and I would get down to 185 or 186. But I wanted that body weight to be all muscle, no fat. I trained nonstop right up until 3 days before the contest. I also went 2 or 3 times a week to an aerobics class at the Sports Connection. I wouldn't have done it except for Arnold. He told me, Franco, I'm not going to help you in Ohio. I'm working there and I don't want to help you at all. Don't ask me who the judges are. You're my friend, but I don't want to talk to you about competing or about judges or anything. But you can talk about training every day. You can call me anytime and I'll go to the gym with you. That's where I can help you. But I don't want to talk about the Olympia. Then he said, get ready and let's go to the Sports Connection. So we get there and he sticks me in a stretching class. And this is after I've already trained 2 hours. Then he takes me for 1 hour into an aerobics class with all these advanced people. I was so embarrassed. I looked like a turtle there moving around. Arnold says, you've got to do it. Then we went upstairs to ride the stationary bicycles, and we broke a bicycle trying to see how fast we could make it go. We got up to 90 miles an hour or something, and the thing broke. And Arnold says, okay, let's leave now. Another thing he did was call the gym every day and ask if I was training. If I wasn't there, he would call me and ask why. Eddie Giuliani and Joe Gold were like two spies for Arnold. They had written down what time I got there, what time I left. They had 2 or 3 other people to watch and make sure I was training enough. Arnold would also come into the gym and once in a while give me little things to do to make the muscles come out in a different place. One day he came up to me and he said, I want you to do front squats on the machine, 10 sets, 20 reps, nonstop, and then you go home. I tried that and it really worked. I got the outside sweep immediately. Then another day he comes in and he says, I want you to do a bent over reverse curl. And I said, what? What is that? I'd never seen it anyplace. He showed me how to take hold of a bar the reverse way, bend forward at a 40 degree angle, and then do the exercise. I did that and the outside head of the bicep came out in 3 days. Came out like a balloon. He showed me something on the leg extension machine I'd never seen before. He said, bring it up and hold it locked out for 3 seconds, which really burns. Joe Weider told me the same thing. He once made me do extensions where you come up slow, hold it, and then go down slow, which is really torture. I tried it with him once, and I was hoping that I would never see him again when I was doing thighs. Joe Weider came in one day when I was posing. I hit a double biceps, and I held it for 1 minute. Then when I was exhausted, he said, okay, now flex. How long should I flex? I asked. Flex from now until the show, he told me. Flex in your sleep. That's how you'll increase your definition and density. And once in a while, Arnold came in and trained with me. That was also stimulating. And with all these things, as we got closer to the contest, I was more and more sure I was going to win because the others weren't changing much and were always talking about calling people like Joe Weider, Jim Lorimer, Ben Weider, and Arnold. I would have been embarrassed to call these people. I was aware of some of the political feeling that the contest was fixed, that I was supposed to be the winner. But I felt the best way to deal with that was to come into the contest so in shape that they couldn't deny I was the best. And I was the best. And I'll tell you why. That is my opinion. All the top guys were in good shape, but they lacked something. Some guys had a lot of size. Some guys had a lot of definition, but nobody had both. I had better proportions, more size, and more definition. I would put Roy Callender second with Platts and Chris Dickerson tied for third. Roy and Tom Platts trained so hard, I couldn't believe it. I left town for a while before the contest to get some sun. I wanted to see if I could win a contest without any paint on my body. Everybody else there was painted but me. I just had on a little bit of oil. My clothes never got dirty. I was so happy about that. I finally got Samir to take his shirt off. The Italian press came to take pictures of me and I said, Samir, do you want to be in the Italian magazines? He said, yes. So I told him to take his shirt off. When I saw the guys backstage in Columbus, I knew I was going to win. They all looked the same as always, but they were all in good shape. Every one of them. Even Danny Padilla had great definition. But a lot of them made the mistake of pumping up too much at the beginning. I knew the prejudging would be long. If you pumped up too much, you'd burn yourself out. Okay, I said, I'm not going to pump up. So I went out for the first round without pumping up. You look at the scores. I got 96, Chris Dickerson 96, Roy Callender 96 in the first round. Then in the second round, I pumped up 15 to 20%, and they're still pumping up full power. Now, I looked a little bigger, and the judges were really impressed. In the third round, I pumped up 80%, and the others were bared out, and that's where I killed them. They got 96s again, and I got 99. I had choreographed my routine, and I had good music. I came out and did a 4.5-minute posing routine, while nobody else's was longer than about 2 minutes. It was a shock for everyone. All the judges were giving me 20s. They couldn't believe that a routine could be that long and good. I got 5 20s and another 99. Chris was good and got a 97. I think I won for many reasons. Physically, I had size, definition, and good proportion, and my posing was really exciting. Chris Dickerson looked good, and his definition surprised me. I thought Callender looked really good, but he was just a little smooth. His skin was a little thick, and that's why he got fourth. Tom Platz looked as good as he could, but I don't think he has his proportions 100% correct yet. Roy Callender, a good poser with a tremendous physique, but it's a mistake to point to the thighs with the finger. If the thighs are good, the judges will see it. Danny Padilla, too, pointed to his calves. If the judges can't see the calves, they don't deserve to be judges. When the finalists were on stage, I thought I had won, but I thought I had done better during the day than at night. At night, Oscar State kept us from doing things. When the crowd didn't like that, when they announced Roy Callender as fourth, I was sure I won because I was more worried about Roy Callender than about Chris Dickerson. Backstage after the contest, Arnold said to me in German, "It's a booing contest, just like last year." Why booing? When Roy Callender was doing his posing routine, the tape with his music broke. Roy is a nice man, and the audience was on his side. When he was announced fourth, that's when they started booing the most. Then when they announced Platz third, they were still booing, and then Dickerson second. The audience wanted Roy Callender there. I think the audience wanted the contest to be between Roy Callender and me. I have a tape of the contest, and it shows this very clearly. Who started the booing? Out of 5,000 people, I know who the first person booing was, Rick Wayne. And I asked him, "Rick, you were the first person to boo me. What are you doing?" And he said, "I was thinking of Australia." It was really funny. I was aware of the problems because of Australia in 1980, but I never considered not competing. I just wanted to be so good that nobody would think my winning was political. When people have a chance to look at the comparison pictures, they will agree that I deserve to be the winner. The truth is, all the competitors at Columbus were in good shape, and I was lucky that my instincts told me to go all out myself and not trust that people would be out of shape. Everyone looked good. Padilla looked really cut next to everyone else but me. I was just as cut, and I made him look small. This year, I plan to get in shape 2 times, in April and May to do shows, and again from July through September. I will do all the exhibitions I can during that time and do the seminars the other months. Promoters are complaining that bodybuilders are coming to shows out of shape, but I won't do that. I don't know if I will compete. I always make that decision exactly 3 months before the competition. I like seminars because they give me a chance to share what I've learned with the people, especially the kids. I credit a lot of success in the Olympia to the training programs I worked out for the last 3.5 to 4 months before the Olympia, and I will be explaining them in detail in future issues of Muscle and Fitness. The end. All right. You got to love Franco. He's entertaining, if nothing else. I think he's definitely a little delusional if he thought he was in proportion. And actually, his routine was not that great either. But that was funny how he was saying how he pumped up just a little bit and then his scores increased. And then the booing actually started with Padilla when he got fifth, not Roy Callender when he got fourth. And I don't think they were booing just because of Roy Callender. They were booing because those guys definitely should have placed higher. But that was a pretty entertaining article, especially when him and Arnold were riding the bikes at 90 miles an hour. Oh, man. Franco and Arnold were two characters that the bodybuilding world has never seen before. That's for sure. All right. Now, Chris Dickerson won the title in 1982, the year after Franco. And I thought there would be an article about Chris after he won the Olympia, but I really couldn't find one. But I did find an article about Chris, which was before the 82 Olympia. And this came from the January 1983. So by this time, the 1982 Olympia had already taken place, but I don't think he won yet. So they must have known that Chris was the favorite that year. And they did an interview with him right before the contest. So I'll read that article right now. This was written by Bill Reynolds, and it says, Chris Dickerson, Iron in the Blood. I'll probably die in the gym, says 43-year-old Chris. I love training. It's a deeply ingrained habit, like brushing my teeth. Has success spoiled Chris Dickerson? No way. Although he's won more IFBB Pro titles than any other bodybuilder and is known worldwide, he remains affable and approachable. Here, in the conclusion of this exclusive interview, Chris talks about the pleasures and pitfalls of the bodybuilding lifestyle. He explained why he's putting all his eggs in one basket, the Mr. Olympia, and he reveals the real secret of his success. When you're training in the gym, do you ever get the feeling that you just can't go on? Of course. I think every bodybuilder, regardless of his or her level of training experience, has felt this way from time to time. One thing we bodybuilders do that's bad is we drink too much black coffee. We get a false sense of the greater energy from the caffeine. This is particularly true of a contest when we're dieting and our energy reserves are depleted. Thousands of bodybuilders started training at roughly the same time you did. Why did you succeed when so many others failed? I think I'm very steady in pursuing whatever I pick up on. I love routine in my life because I'm Virgo and by nature very methodical. Being very methodical has been a great help to me both as a person and as a bodybuilder. I've succeeded only because I've stuck to my training when most others either quit or train sporadically. Do you prefer to train alone or with a partner? Alone, unless I can find a really good partner. The average training partner ends up following me in the workout, so he's getting more from me than I'm getting from him. I don't need to take energy from someone else in order to have a good workout. When I train with Bill Pearl, it's a very beneficial experience, but ordinarily I prefer to train alone. Bodybuilding to me is a very private sort of endeavor, and I absolutely detest someone standing over me, counting my reps, and screaming at me to do a couple more. When that happens, I become more aware of their being there than what I'm doing, and this distracts from my concentration on the muscle I'm working. Do you feel that you've been blessed genetically? Oh, yes, without question. I have been blessed. I have natural muscularity and very good skin texture. My structure is very good, and I seem to have a very youthful metabolism. I feel that I've been very fortunate in every way, except in not being blessed with great height. You can't have everything, though. For which contest do you feel you were physically at your best? The Washington Grand Prix in 1981. I was really ripped, so ripped that I wasn't called out for a single comparison. I just stood there. And at first it bothered me, but I knew I was in great shape. So I soon concluded that the judges felt I was so obviously the winner that they were comparing for the other places. Where did you receive your greatest audience response? Wow, that's hard to pin down. I've always had a tremendous response from London audiences when I competed for the NABBA Mr. Universe in the past. Recently, I'd say I've gotten my best responses at the California Grand Prix at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium and at the Night of the Champions in New York City. New York audiences are very critical. They either love you or hate you. New York's a double-edged sword in that you can get a lot of cheers, but you can also get some very loud boos. You seem to jump frequently from coast to coast. Is there any reason for that? Are you in California for keeps? I feel that I'll be in California for as long as I'm a professional bodybuilder, because this is the Mecca for bodybuilding. Here I'm among my peers, and I feel more appreciated as a person in California than I did in New York. I love New York as a city, and I love the stimulation, but I'm not quite the same person there as I am here. New York, however, offers cultural benefits that California doesn't. I still have my apartment in Manhattan. How much longer do you think you'll be training for competition, for exhibitions and seminars? For exhibitions, I'd say indefinitely. For competition, I'm taking it one step at a time. Having been fortunate enough to have won the overall Grand Prix twice, the Canada Cup twice, and the World Couples Championship twice, I feel that the Olympia is the one thing I still want to aim for. Depending on what happens this year, I'll make a decision about whether or not to continue competing. If I'm fortunate enough to win the Mr. Olympia, I may just retire. Even if I retire, however, I'll always remain in good shape so I can continue to give exhibitions and seminars. And then there's a note here. It says, as this issue goes to press, the Olympia is about to get underway in London. Look for the results in Muscle and Fitness soon. So you're a bodybuilder for life. Oh, definitely. Training is a habit that's as deeply ingrained as brushing my teeth. If I don't train, I get irritable. Bodybuilding is a great sport and I love it. I'll probably die in the gym. Who, in your opinion, is the greatest bodybuilder of all time? Oh, you know I'm going to say Bill Pearl. I feel that Sergio Oliva had the most natural gifts as a bodybuilder, but I don't think he actualized his potential to the same degree that Bill Pearl has. Bill Pearl competed in the Mr. Universe competition every 5 years or so for nearly 20 years, and he won 4 Mr. Universe titles. He competed at such a high level for so long that 3 generations of bodybuilders have known him and admired him. To me, that's why he's so great. How strong are you? Fairly strong. Do you feel that strength is a definitive factor in bodybuilding? No. A physique is not determined as much by the use of extremely heavy weights as many people think. Intensity and the accumulation of many years of consistently intense training makes a bodybuilder. In the beginning, it's important that you squat, bench press, deadlift, and so on with heavy weights to build up a foundation for strength. After a year or two, however, this becomes much less important. In the late 60s, bodybuilders competing in the AAU events used to have to attain athletic points, mainly through competitive weightlifting, to do well in the Mr. America contest. As I recall, you did some Olympic lifting for a while to get your points. Did it improve your physique? Yes, my traps, shoulders, lower back, and thighs benefited noticeably. Lifts like the clean and jerk require the use of virtually every muscle group in the body, so they tend to tie a bodybuilder's whole physique together. Weightlifting gives you a rugged and well-knit look. In contrast, some bodybuilders have isolated impressive body parts, but their physiques never seem to come together. What do you feel is the real secret to bodybuilding success? In a word, consistency. Be consistent in your training and diet, and be consistent in competing despite occasional setbacks. Are you satisfied with pro bodybuilding today, with the direction it's taking? I feel we've had a setback in the last 2 years in terms of judging consistency, and we've had only one American Grand Prix competition this year. After going great guns, we're regressing. If we get too many bad decisions in the Olympia, we lose out in the end. The Olympia hasn't even been televised the past 2 years. If it becomes too controversial, the press won't want to have anything to do with it. We'll have to make the contest fairer in order to rekindle the interest of the mass media. And we also need to build the number of pro contests back up to the level of a couple of years ago. When we do get back on the right track, and I'm very optimistic that we will, I think we'll have a sport that will continue to gain in popularity through the end of the century. What do you think of couples competition? I think it's great, and it will become more and more popular. When a man and a woman up there posing, the general public can grasp the idea of a competition much better. You can do so many more things in couples posing than when you're on stage alone. We can do all sorts of lifts and dance movements and end up looking amazingly athletic. You've won the World Couples Championship twice. Do you think you'll give that competition another shot? I'd definitely like to compete with it again with Lynn Conkright, with new music and a new routine. What's your relationship with Joe Weider like? When I first came into the IFBB, I wasn't sure that he felt I'd be loyal to the Federation. I thought I had to prove myself to him, and I tried hard. Now we have a mutual respect. He's helped me out with my training and my posing, and without the exposure he's given me in muscle and fitness, it would be very difficult for me to be a successful pro bodybuilder. I'm recognized everywhere, and I mean all over the world, since I began competing in the IFBB, and I've been featured regularly in muscle and fitness. With whom do you best relate in the sport? Most of us in the pro bodybuilding ranks get along very well. I relate particularly well to Frank Zane, Mike Menser, and Casey Viator. Even though Casey and I went tooth and nail against each other in 5 Grand Prix contests in 1980, we have an excellent friendship. We badly wanted to defeat each other on stage, but in the gym, we're still good friends. Casey's a great competitor. Where do you train and why there? I used to train at both Gold's Gym and World Gym, but now I work out exclusively at Gold's. My office is right above the gym floor at Gold's. I can walk next door to the locker room to dress and then go downstairs and train anytime I want. It's very convenient. How does the average bodybuilder react to you? I'm amazed at how some of them seem to be intimidated by me. I tend to think people don't come up to me and talk because they're unfriendly, but it's invariably because they're intimidated. Once we're introduced, however, everything goes quite well. I feel that I'm a very approachable bodybuilder and people shouldn't be afraid to come up and talk with me about the sport. And how does the average person react to you? They'll look at me for a while and then they'll say that they know I'm into bodybuilding and they like what they see. Their usual reaction today is much more positive than it was just 5 years ago. Bodybuilding is obviously much more accepted by the general public, which is all for the better as far as I'm concerned. We used to get catcalls and other ridiculous reactions. Every bodybuilder was supposed to be a muscle-bound idiot. Today, the general public treats us more and more like the serious athletes we are, and this is great because it attracts more people to the sport. Top bodybuilders get massive amounts of publicity, and as a result, they take on an almost godlike status in the sport. How do you react to that? I just have to deal with it. I like respect and a certain degree of adoration. Who doesn't? But on the other hand, I don't like being treated as anything more than Chris Dickerson, man and bodybuilder. After competing in virtually every pro contest in 1980 and 81, you haven't competed at all this year. Why? I want to save myself for the Olympia this year. You can look good at every contest over the course of a year or two, but you can't make any appreciable improvements from month to month, at least not enough for the judges to notice. And then no matter how good you look on stage, the judges tend to get a little bored with you. It's sort of like, oh, well, here's Chris again, and he looks good, but by laying out of the competition for a year, I can look quite a bit better to the judges. I think that was the advantage for Tom Platz last year. He was able to lay out of competition for a year and make quite an improvement. So I've been using this year as a long buildup for the Olympia. I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. What in bodybuilding turns you on the most? Well, first, you feel great physically. You're very much in tune with your body, much more so than in any other sport. There's also a certain degree of vanity, I'm sure. You want to look good on the beach and in clothes, and you take pride in the way you look. I'll be 43 by the time this interview is published, and I certainly don't look or feel 43. The notion that I can halt or at least slow the aging process is a major factor in keeping me in the gym. What in bodybuilding turns you off the most? I think that some people in the sport, unfortunately they are in the minority, take it too seriously. Some think winning is everything, and when they lose, they have temper tantrums and smash trophies. I also detest seeing young bodybuilders think they can make it to the top just by using drugs. It's a matter of hard work and persistence. It's become some sort of cliche to say this, but today's champs would still be the champions if steroids didn't exist. You have to pay your dues in the gym and at the table, not at the pharmacy, to make it to the top. How do you relax? I listen to music because it both relaxes and inspires me. I also like to read. Other than bodybuilding magazines, what do you read? I read Omni, the science fiction and futurism magazine. I like Time. I prefer biographies. What movies do you like best? Believe it or not, my favorite movie last year was not Chariots of Fire, but Excalibur, even though it was a critical flop. I like heroic films like that. I especially like the use of Wagner's music with the heroic images. It would have been better with male and female bodybuilders playing the lead roles, but it was still an excellent and enjoyable film. I like the feel of the film. Do you watch television? Seldom. For the most part, television is junk culture and watching it depresses me. Do you save your copies of Muscle and Fitness for future reference? I save the ones with articles that are particularly valuable to me. Overall, I think saving and reviewing bodybuilding magazines is valuable for someone coming up in the sport. By reading a mag through more than once, a young bodybuilder can learn a lot more about the sport. Do you keep a scrapbook? A friend has compiled a great scrapbook for me. I'm lazy about keeping that sort of thing up to date, so I'm very glad he did it. Otherwise, I'd have no record of my bodybuilding career. Do you object to people talking to you while you're training? Not really, as long as they're sensitive enough to avoid doing it in the middle of a set and can accept the fact that I'll be back into another set a minute later. I can exchange a few words quite easily before I go on to my next set, and I feel like it's often a bit of relief from the training grind. While I'm doing a set, though, all my concentration must be on the working muscle. Anyone who distracts me then by talking to me should beware of my wrath. Do you like music in the gym when you're training? If it's too quiet in the gym, I feel uncomfortable. Some of the pop music they play at Gold's gives me an extra flush of energy during a workout. A few years ago, Ed Corney took bodybuilding posing to new heights. Now you've been credited for taking it from Corney's then innovative style to its current zenith as an art form. How did you develop your unique posing style? Well, to begin with, I studied ballet when I was going to acting school. I was also a fairly good gymnast in school. And as I mentioned earlier in Muscle and Fitness, my acting training has given me the ability to convey feelings and emotions on stage through a sort of pantomime. It has also helped me to have both a vivid imagination and good powers of observation. With these skills, I've been able to see an athletic movement or something that a ballet dancer like Baryshnikov does and extrapolate that to bodybuilding posing. Essentially, I try to visualize a pose that I've never seen before and then work on it in front of a mirror and see how it helps display my physique in a unique way. When people come to me for help with their posing, I tell them that they have poses within themselves that they've never seen. and that no one else has ever seen. And once they're told this, they can usually bring unique new poses into their routines. In my own posing practice, I try not to be limited by what I've seen on the posing platform. I try to always be imaginative. And with that philosophy in mind, I've been able to evolve quite a number of unique poses, as well as new transitions between poses. Have you ever used the services of a choreographer? Yes, but more for couples presentation. The lifts and the way a man and woman relate to each other in a dance sense are important in couples competition, and there a dance choreographer can be quite useful. A young male or female bodybuilder might benefit quite a bit from working with a choreographer, particularly in terms of developing smooth and eye-catching transitions. We've touched on this briefly, but I'd like to go into it a little more deeply. Do you enjoy the adulation of your fans? Yes, I do. I'm sure that the fans are one big reason many bodybuilders continue to compete. It's a great responsibility, however, because you have to constantly measure up to their expectations. I enjoy the responsibility, but many bodybuilders, as well as other athletes, are hurt by it. In sports psychology, there's a concept called fear of success, in which many athletes subconsciously fear bearing the responsibilities that go with being a champion. So they subconsciously take steps to avoid winning. I'm sure that many bodybuilders would do better competitively if they could learn to love the responsibilities and the pleasures that come from being a champion in any sport. What's the strangest thing that's ever happened to you in bodybuilding? Well, more than once, I've pigged out so much after a show that I get the hiccups periodically for 3 days straight. I later learned that I've eaten so much that my stomach stretched my diaphragm to the point of spasm, causing the hiccups. People often laugh about having hiccups, but it was very painful. I couldn't even sleep when I had them. What's your favorite junk out? Red meat, wine, and cheesecake. I can eat a whole cheesecake after a competition. We talked earlier about couples competition. What do you think of women's bodybuilding? I used to hate it. When I first saw a picture of a woman doing a double biceps pose, I felt that it wasn't feminine, and a woman could never look like a man anyway. Now I've changed my opinion entirely. I can accept anything that is done well. The women are so imaginative in their posing that many men could take lessons from them. What do you enjoy most, competing or training? Oh, the training by far. I'd have continued to train over the years even if there had been no contest to enter. Training is for yourself. You're not in the gym competing against anyone, but working out for your own enjoyment and benefit. Competing is putting everything on the line. So many things can go wrong then that competition completely turns off a lot of bodybuilders. The dieting is a burden. Training before a competition becomes a burden too. It's odd to some people, but on the Monday after a show, when I can go back to training for myself again, I come into the gym in a great mood and with the world's biggest smile. Do you consider bodybuilding preparations a sacrifice? Definitely. This is particularly true of your social life, although this isn't a burden to me since I'm a confirmed bachelor. But I have a lot of friends who are married and bring their families into all of it, even though they might have little or no potential for success in the sport. I try to tell them, don't make bodybuilding your whole life. Don't uproot your family and move out here to train. Don't put your marriage on the line every contest. Every bodybuilder must have a balanced life, or he can be hurt in the long run. Do you feel that self-discipline that you've developed in bodybuilding has helped you in the rest of your life? Definitely. I think sport reflects life. You win a few and you lose a few in life, just as in bodybuilding. There's a lot to be said for being able to bounce back from defeat. You have to give life your best shot. Show the character and persistence that you've built in bodybuilding by hanging in there. I've noticed that when you're competing, you totally ignore other bodybuilders who try to engage you in a pose down. Why? I'm never going to play another bodybuilder's game. He's paying me the highest possible form of compliment by coming out of line to stand next to me. He's saying to the audience and judges that Chris Dickerson is the man to beat. That hasn't necessarily been established at that point, but he's admitting it to himself and to everyone else in the auditorium. I do my own poses and make him play my game rather than playing his. Is there anything else you'd like to get off your chest? Well, I'd like the writers who cover bodybuilding contests to be more positive in their reports. At times, I feel some of them must hate bodybuilding. Bodybuilding is an incredible sport, and if I didn't love it so much, I wouldn't be competing. We must work together with the IFBB to keep promoting bodybuilding. All right, the end. All right, that was an interesting article with Chris Dickerson, very well spoken. One of the most articulate and intelligent Mr. Olympias we've had. All right. One more here. This was Samir Banute. So this comes from the March 1994 issue of Muscle and Fitness. And of course, this was right after the 1983 Mr. Olympia that Samir won. And it says, my secret to Mr. Olympia's success, the higher you climb, the more you can see. Having scaled the highest peak in bodybuilding success, the newest Mr. Olympia knows the rewards of keeping his sights set high. And this was also written by Bill Reynolds. When I first saw Samir Banute at the 1978 Mr. International competition in Columbus, Ohio, I knew he'd one day become a great bodybuilder. His potential was obvious in the incredible bone structure and natural symmetry that he already displayed. And when I talked to him, Samir projected a deep love for the sport of bodybuilding. Samir's journey to the top has been one of peaks and valleys. Peaks when he won the Mr. World and Mr. Universe titles. Valleys when he placed abysmally in the 80 and 81 Mr. Olympia competitions. But in the past 2 years, Samir's star has gone only upward until he finally realized his dream of winning Mr. Olympia. Here, in Samir's own words, is his story of a long climb to the top. Bill Reynolds. Bodybuilding is very much a sport of mental attitude. It's also as much a science as a sport. Competition, particularly at the Mr. Olympia level, is so stiff that you must be thoroughly educated in the science of the sport and totally dedicated to win. For every mistake that you make in bodybuilding, there is a solution. For every question, there is an answer. And I was able to answer the questions posed by my losses at the 1980 and 81 Mr. Olympia sufficiently to reach optimum condition in 82 and finally win the Mr. Olympia in 83. Even as a boy in Beirut, I had such a love of bodybuilding and such a desire to become a success in it that I knew I would be able to do something big in the sport one day. But I didn't dare dream about becoming Mr. Olympia. That dream would come many years later after I moved to America. I finally began to believe that I would become Mr. Olympia back in 1978 when I placed well in the Mr. International competition won by Joe Nazario in Columbus. By then, I was living in Michigan, and even though I was working long, hard hours at an auto plant, my body was improving so quickly and dramatically that I began to realize I could win Mr. Olympia. In 1979, I won the Mr. World and Mr. Universe titles, and I felt that 1980 would be my year to add the Mr. Olympia title to my collection. Unfortunately, I made mistakes in my preparations that year and the following year as well. I had to gain experience, experiment with different variables, and learn more about my body to be worthy of the Mr. Olympia title. I discovered ways to avoid past mistakes. Oddly, I was just making minor mistakes, but they had major effects on my appearance on stage. My water retention problem was merely the result of mismanaged stress. Now that I have it under control, I don't want to hear any more about it. My winning formula is simple. Great shape and symmetry, perfect proportions, a good degree of muscle mass, bone-deep muscularity, and good stage presence and posing ability. Also, I wanted to win the title more than anything in life. You need such desire to be a winner in the world's biggest bodybuilding competition. Considering the current pro ranks, I feel that I can continue to win the Mr. Olympia as long as I keep improving and always enter the competition in ripped up condition. I believe I have more physical advantages and better symmetry than any of the men currently competing. I will be back at the next Mr. Olympia contest in New York City, weighing 5 or 6 pounds more and with even better muscularity. Count on it. I really didn't prepare any differently this year than before, except that my mental attitude was a lot better. I got so much more encouragement that it was easier to keep my stress levels down. After looking so good in the 82 Mr. Olympia in London, I definitely felt like I was the man to beat in 83. While I like Chris Dickerson very much as a person, and I respect him as a great professional, I firmly believe that Casey Viator and myself were the best shape of all the bodybuilders at the 82 Mr. Olympia. While training in California, I work out at both Gold's and World Gym. Obviously, I could do good full body workouts in either gym, but I prefer to train my lower body at World and my upper body at Gold's. I plan to give you detailed information about how I train in an article soon for Muscle and Fitness, but I'll briefly tell you how I worked out to win the Mr. Olympia. I trained pretty much the same all year, except that the workouts got harder and harder the closer the contest came because I wanted to win so badly. I was following a program of training 3 days and then taking 1 day to rest, and I worked out only once per day most of the time. The first day I hit chest, shoulders, and triceps. The second I did my lower body, including calves. And the third I bombed back, biceps, and abdominals. I did tend to train my abs a little more frequently as the Mr. Olympia approached. Sets and reps, To be honest with you, I counted neither. I just went according to the Weider instinctive training principle, and I worked a set until my muscles told me to stop, and I worked a muscle until I knew it had had enough. A typical number of sets was probably 10 to 15 for most body parts, both in the off season and before the Mr. Olympia. But before my competition, the intensity within each set was greatly increased, and I did a little aerobic activity, jogging and stationary cycling. The closer I came to the Mr. Olympia, the crazier I got in my training, and the closer I pushed myself to the absolute limit. Instead of stopping when my body told me to stop, as was the case in the off season, I pushed past that point. It was a hellish type of training, but it did the trick. I won the title, didn't I? 2.5 weeks before the Mr. Olympia contest, I went to Germany to finish my training at Reinhold Pregler's gym in Munich because it has a very good equipment and it was a place where I could train without any distractions. Erwin Noller, who was second to Dale Ruplinger in last year's World Championships, was my training partner. We had some incredible workouts. I also went to Germany because I wanted to be over jet lag well before the competition. It takes a full day for each hour of time change to fully readjust, so I had several days to spare. And I wanted to get away from the unique last week's stresses of training in California with everyone trying to psych out the other Mr. Olympia competitors. Finally, I wanted to leave my Swedish girlfriend, Tina Doss, in California because I get really touchy just before a show and I wanted to avoid a fight. She's a wonderful person and she gave me total support. Tina came to Germany 3 days before the show and she was amazed at the change of my physique. By then, I wasn't cut, I was shredded. My workouts had been so hard that after each one, I was almost dead. I was eating only 1,000 to 1,500 calories per day. And the last 10 days, I went on low carbs, less than 30 grams a day. Then I really went crazy. Everyone says that I look like a zombie. I was always hungry, even right after eating. To win the Mr. Olympia, I had to pay the price, which was starving for a week and a half. Before the carbohydrate restriction, I ate mainly broiled chicken without the skin, salad without dressing, baked potatoes, and a little fruit. Even with a low level of calories, this wasn't a bad diet. I had to use carbohydrate deprivation to deplete my muscle glycogen and then load up on carbs, but only complex carbs, beginning 72 hours before the show, so my muscles would be full and ripped at the same time. It's torture, but it works. I have so many people to thank for helping me get to the Mr. Olympia. Of course, there's Tina. And there's always Joe Weider, who supported me fully since I moved to California in 1978. When I finally moved into the hotel where the competitors stayed in Munich, I called Joe, and Tina and I went up to his room for some final work on my posing. I showed the Master Blaster my condition, and his enthusiasm gave me a needed boost. If you yearn to one day be Mr. Olympia, always remember that bodybuilding is a science, because you need to master a wide variety of scientific subjects, such as anatomy, kinesiology, biochemistry, exercise physiology, and psychology. That interview with Bill Reynolds at the 1978 Mr. International show was, for me, the beginning of a long journey of learning about bodybuilding. Bodybuilding is a sport in which you never stop learning, and that's why I always say, the higher you climb, the more you can see. Next month, I'll write about my entire training and dietary philosophy for an exclusive article for Muscle and Fitness. Until then, good luck with your training, and remember to keep learning. And Samir said that quote after he won the Mr. Olympia in 1983, and he was interviewed by NBC Sports World on television. So he said, the higher you climb, the more you can see. And of course, I do a show every week with Samir, so I've gotten to know him pretty well. We do a show called Muscle Maturity that's on YouTube every week. So check that out. We usually put that up every Wednesday where we talk about what's going on in bodybuilding. All right, guys, that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope everybody has a wonderful Thanksgiving this week, and we will be back next week. Hopefully we will have a guest, but if not, I will find something else to put on the show, maybe read some more old classic bodybuilding magazines or talk about some subject that's going on in the world of bodybuilding. But until then, train hard, stay safe, and we will see you guys next week. Take care.